I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Moncrief on News Talk. From the heinous to the ridiculous. This is Moncrief's Murder Club.
Today, Cathy Delaney will be guiding us through some more strange and unusual cases. And I suppose the theme today we're talking about where the wrong person was blamed.
Yeah. This is a kind of like a somber theme. I have a mix of stories for you, but I'll get straight into this big one. This is a trial that has fascinated me for years. There's a fantastic piece by the journalist Dave Gann on this, like a really long read that's been made into films. And it is the story of a man called Cameron Todd Willingham. So back in 1991, 23rd of December, everyone's gearing up for Christmas, nice little time. And we're in this small town in Texas, about an hour south of Dallas, the kind of town where everybody knows everyone, everybody knows everyone's business. And Cameron Todd Willingham wakes up in the morning. His wife, Stacy, is going out thrift shopping to get Christmas presents. That's what the Americans call secondhand shopping. So she leaves Todd behind with her three daughters, 2-year-old Amber and 1-year-old twins, Cameron and Carmen. So three little girls, all under the age of 2, in a house on West 11th Street. Todd goes back to sleep. And an hour later, he's woken up to the sounds of the kids crying. The house is full of smoke. And as he comes out of the bedroom trying to get to the girls' room, he sees the glow of the ceiling. Trying to step over the safety gate, his hair catches fire and he feels around the darkness for his daughters, but he can't find them. So the house starts crumbling in. There is fire everywhere. This is just the whole thing has gone on fire. And he stumbles out the front door, screaming to neighbours to call 911 and saying that I can't, my babies are in there and I can't get them out. So he tries to go back in, but the heat is just too much. He can't get into the house. When the firefighters arrive, they pull the girls out, but it's too late. All three have perished, died of smoke inhalation. Very, very sad. Stacey comes back and sees the house burned down and the kids. And it's just a tragedy, absolutely devastating in the days leading up to Christmas. But what happens next is just like, you just couldn't predict it. So within days, fire investigators are crawling over the wreckage and they find what they say are signs of arson. So burn patterns on the floor that they describe as puddle shapes. So the idea that something had been poured and ignited. They also note that there is multiple starting points. So these multiple kind of patterns around the place. And they think that that's indicative that someone has intentionally set this fire. So their conclusion, barely after a week of the fire, it was that this was deliberate and that someone had poured flammable liquid across the home and set it alight with the three children inside intentionally. So immediately it goes to who has motive. And all fingers start pointing towards Todd. He was jobless since November. He was a known kind of bit of a drinker. He did have a record in his teen years where he'd kind of been done for theft and driving under the influence.
That certainly is very interesting because you see this as well in sexual assault cases that if the victim isn't sympathetic.
Yeah, there's no such thing as the perfect victim, nor is there like the perfect perpetrator. We want these evil people because that's how we understand them. And this was a man who had made mistakes in his past, I would say. But he's not very nice. He's not a nice guy. We'll get down to it later. He's a bit tricky when he gets to prison. He likes to flip people off. He's, you know, loose with his language. He's not the gentleman that you kind of want to feel sorry for. He's a complicated character. And he's a known drinker as well. So he was the only man in the house at the time. And in the days after they buried the girls, he was seen in a bar having a beer. He'd been talking about his dartboard that was burnt down in the fire as well. And people started pointing to these things and thinking that he was a shady kind of character and that he must have been culpable and guilty. So like only a few days later, on the 8th of January in 1992, just the night before he turned 24, SWAT team come to arrest him and he is charged with 3 counts of capital murder. So its trial is set for August 1992. And the case rests on two pillars. The first is the arson science. And this is the testimony that the evidence is conclusive, the pore patterns. There's a low burn profile on this fire. There's multiple origin points. And the fire marshal at the time tells the jury that the fire does not lie. The second pillar in the case is a jailhouse informant called Johnny Webb, who was a 22-year-old drug addict who had shared a cell with Todd at some point. And he testifies that Todd confessed to him, saying that he poured lighter fluid around the house and lit it up. The prosecutor asks Webb directly, "Have I promised you anything in return for your testimony?" And Webb says no. So the jury go away to deliberate for less than an hour, and Todd is found guilty on all three counts. And because we're in Texas, he's sentenced to death.
Mm. What's Stacey's position on this?
Stacey stands by him. Stacey says that she testifies in court that he loved those girls and would not have done anything to harm them. But the rest of the town and everyone else has decided that he's a monster. For years, he declares his innocence. And for a really long time, Stacey stands by him as well. But he's locked up in prison. He's on death row. It doesn't seem like he's getting out. So she does eventually kind of separate from him and move on. But she has always maintained that he wouldn't have harmed the girls. He spent 12 years on death row maintaining his innocence throughout. And his appeals are denied again and again and again. So in the final weeks, just before his scheduled execution, his lawyers make one last attempt, and they hire a man called Gerald Hurst, who is a nationally recognised arson expert, a Cambridge-educated chemist who has spent his entire career investigating fire science, and they asked him to review the evidence. His report lands on the desk of the Texas governor and the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and his conclusion is like unambiguous. He says that every single indicator of arson cited at the trial was wrong, that there was no way that this was a fire that had been intentionally started. Said the pore patterns were consistent with a phenomenon called flashover, which is when a fire basically gets so hot that it kind of everything in the room ignites at once because of the temperature. And that these patterns that they were calling puddle patterns were just signs of that. And it had been well documented and consistent. So they look like accelerant patterns, but they aren't. So the report is received, but the execution goes ahead anyway. And Cameron Todd Willingham, on the 17th of February 2004, is put to death by lethal injection in the Texas State Penitentiary. So he's only 36 old at the time. And in his formal statement, he maintains his innocence. He says, "I'm an innocent man convicted of a crime I did not commit. I've been persecuted for 12 years for something I did not know. I did not do." And in his final moments, like, this is the kind of thing, I don't think he's well liked, you know. He doesn't go out politely. Like, he's screaming obscenities. He flips off the witness. You know, he's going out with a bang every chance he can get. But after the execution, the stories don't go away. So the Innocence Project picked up on this, and they assembled five of America's leading fire scientists to review the evidence. And a 48-page report finds that not one of the arson indicators used to convict Willingham met any scientific standard. Every single one was dismissed. The Texas Forensic Expert Commission agreed to investigate, and in 2009, the commission's own hired expert, a man called Dr. Craig Baylor, delivered his findings that the investigators in the original trial had a poor understanding of fire science and relied on discredited folklore. So again, another conclusion that there was no scientific basis for calling the fire arson. Meanwhile, then, the Marshall Project tracked down Johnny Webb, the informant, and he says, again, on record, detailed account of how the prosecutor had coached his testimony and put him under pressure to say it. And a note surfaces suggesting that he had, in fact, received preferential treatment and a reduced sentence in order for, you know, in return for the testimony. And there's another kind of crucial piece of information here, and that is that at the same time, there was another man called Ernest Willis, who had also been on death row at exactly the same time, convicted of an arson murder case that completely mirrored Cameron Todd Willingham's. The puddle signs, the same kind of experts using. And that case was thrown out after it was proven that those scientific bases were just made up.
That's like, astounding, yeah.
Isn't it? So that's kind of where we ended up with this story. Nine independent fire experts said that it was not arson. he was sentenced to death. He did die. And right now, as we stand today, Texas has never formally exonerated him. The state's official position to this day is that the conviction still stands.
Yeah. Is there even any acknowledgement that the scientific conclusions were dodgy in the first place?
Yeah,
the original guy wasn't as well qualified. He wasn't a forensic expert.
Their own independent report found that it was wrong. So they the least they could do now is exonerate him and, you know, at least clear his name somewhat for the sake of his surviving family, for Stacey's sake. But they just don't see, I mean, if they do that, there's compensation that has to be paid.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. God, that's extraordinary. Right, our second story. Now, and did you say films have been made about
this? There is a film. The piece by David Gann is called Trial by Fire. That's in The New Yorker and it's a brilliant read. It's a good meaty long read, like sit down of a Sunday and read that. And then there is a film called Trial by Fire as well.
Right, okay, because that's interesting because the second story is also the name of a film as well that people might remember. Clint Eastwood directed it, Richard Jewell.
Yes, this poor man.
Yeah.
Poor man in all sense of the word. This, we're going to talk about like the 88 worst days of this man's life. So in July 27th in 1996, we're in Atlanta, Georgia, and the Summer Olympics are in full swing. There's about 50,000 people packed into the Olympic Park for a concert. The city's buzzing. You know that kind of energy that's around when you've got a big event like that happening. And at nearly midnight, there's a band playing, crowds enormous, celebrations all around. The security guard at the time is Richard Jewell. He's 33 years old. He's kind of an awkward character, kind of a heavyset man. He wanted to be in law enforcement his whole life, but hadn't made that leap, hadn't broken through, had ended up in security. He'd worked as a prison guard, a campus cop, a house detective. And this gig working at the Olympics at security was just a temporary one for him. So kind of, you know, he's just trying. It was kind of the latest move in a career that had never really taken off. And just after midnight, he notices a group of young men lingering near a beach and they scatter when he approaches. And under the bench, he finds a green army backpack. He says something feels wrong and he alerted the Bureau of Investigation. They call in the bomb squad. They start clearing around people from the area. So well spotted. But at 1:20 a.m., the bomb inside the backpack goes off and one woman, unfortunately, is killed. A cameraman dies of a heart attack rushing towards the scene, but over 100 people are injured. So this is, you know, mass chaos. But because of Richard and spotting it early, the death toll is nowhere near it probably would have been had it just been allowed to kind of go off and no one spotted it. A designer at a nearby AT&T tower say that he saw Jewell run up and down four stories, evacuating 40 to 50 staff members. So he was a hero. Like he had really kind of jumped into action. And for days, Richard Jewell is considered a hero. The press coverage covers him warmly. He gives interviews. His mother's bursting with pride. And it is, for all intents and purposes, a dream come true for Richard Jewell that he's recognised as this kind of heroic case. But then the FBI step in and they are investigating what has happened and who's responsible for this. And there's a theory that emerges within the FBI based on psychological profiling, which we've known in years after is sometimes inconsistent and not doesn't really hold up in court. But the idea that Richard is a hero bomber, so a type the FBI believed existed, a person who would plant a bomb and then discovers it in order to look heroic. Jewell fit the profile they constructed. He was a frustrated law enforcement wannabe. He craved validation. He was at the scene. He had called in the alert. And then a reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution gets a tip from an FBI source that Jewell is under investigation and she publishes the tip. So within hours, every major American news outlet has picked up on the story. Camera crews and reporters descend on his apartment where he lives with his mother and they set up camp. And it means that Richard cannot leave for months. So the FBI shows up at his door and asks him to come in for an interview. And they tell him he's not a suspect. They just need him to help recreating events for a training video. And he loves the FBI. So he's flattered. He goes in and he sits down. And when he does, they put a piece of paper in front of him that says you have the right to remain silent. And they arrest him. And he realizes that obviously it's not a training video, that he's kind of he's been, you know, taken into custody here. So for the next 3 months, he lives essentially under siege. The FBI go through his bins. They monitor his phone calls. They are combing the grass around his building. They search his apartment, take his belongings. And the press is relentless here with him. The, you know, NBC, CNN, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the New York Post, all running this story of a man that they've decided is America's biggest villain. They ridicule him. They call him a fat, failed former sheriff's deputy. Jay Leno's mocking him repeatedly on The Tonight Show. Outlets are theorizing that he planted the bomb to engineer a romance with a female law enforcement officer at the scene. There's all this speculation about him, all these horrendous things being said about him. And then during all this time, he can't leave his flat. He can't leave his apartment without being filmed. He can't eat in restaurants. He can't buy groceries. He and his mother are essentially prisoners in their own home during this time. And through it all, every camera and every headline, every late night joke is he hasn't been charged with anything. This is all just pure speculation. He's not actually a suspect in the legal case. He's just a man the FBI is looking at and interested in. And that's enough, it seems, for the entire country to have put him on trial and just ruin his life. His lawyer called it a legal lynching. So on 88 days, on the 26th of October 1996, 88 days after the bombing, the US attorney finally writes him a letter. The letter does not contain an apology. It just says that he's no longer a target and not a target of the investigation. And that's it. That's the vindication. It's all over for him. He can go on. The real bomber, a man called Eric Robert Rudolph, was a domestic terrorist who went on to bomb two abortion clinics and a gay nightclub. After this bombing, he wasn't arrested until 7 years later in 2003. He was out hiding in the wilderness and he pleaded guilty in 2005. But at this point, Richard Jewell had still spent years being the villain and being the bad guy and like trying to repair your reputation like after that in the public realm is nearly impossible. It's like the more you protest, the more guilty you seem. He did spend years suing the organizations that had destroyed his reputation. He got a settlement from CNN, a settlement from NBC. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution never actually settled with him. But in 1997, the Attorney General did say that, "I'm very sorry it happened. I think I owe him an apology." He did get a lot of money out of it, but he lived a very sad life, I think, after that. And his health was really poor after this whole incident. He actually died in 2007 at the age of 44. He had kind of suffered from diabetes, kidney disease and a heart condition and had spent essentially the last decade of his life kind of living under caution rather than a hero. And the thing was, he actually was the hero.
Yeah. That's extraordinary, isn't it? That's absolutely extraordinary. Now, the third case isn't necessarily so much where the wrong people were arrested. It's just a really interesting way to get away with something.
Yeah, it's like we definitely caught the wrong guy. We caught the right guy, but we can't tell which one it is. This is a very interesting one, kind of funny. And this must happen quite a bit, actually. This is a story about two brothers who walked away from a $5 million jewellery heist. Not because they were clever, not because the police were incompetent, but because of biology. So on the 25th of February in 2009, three men in masks break into this prestigious department store in Europe. It's in Berlin. It's basically like a Harrods kind of Selfridges, just big luxury items. They go straight to the luxury watch and jewellery counter and they raid the place. They're fast, professional, clean and get away with €5 million worth of watches and jewellery. The police are kind of not really hopeless here. The raid is caught on CCTV, but the men are all masked. But one of the thieves drops a glove at the scene, an entire glove, which is great because while you can't get fingerprints from a glove, you can, of course, get DNA. And they get an exact, or, you know, they extract a DNA match from it and they get a match. Twin brothers known to the police as Hassan and Abbas O. So they must have felt at the time like this is great. The case is over. They have the CCTV. They have the DNA. They have suspects with records. They bring the brothers in. But then it all falls apart because they're not just brothers. They're identical twins. And identical twins are developed using the same fertilized egg, which means they have the same DNA. So the test that matched the glove to one of the brothers, they couldn't tell which one it was. And the police could not tell. And the boys were really smart here. Instead of speaking or doing anything, they just stayed silent the whole time. They didn't point the finger at each other. They didn't try and get, like, they didn't try and save themselves. So the CCTV footage was proven useless because they were masked. No fingerprints from the gloves. And the brothers, thinking in advance, maybe, thinking maybe they just got very lucky, didn't accuse each other. They didn't confess. They just sat there looking identical and waited for it all to kind of pass. The police tried everything they could. They interviewed witnesses. They searched both brothers' homes. The jewellery was never found. And the longer the investigation went on, the clearer it became that there was no way to charge one brother without charging them both. and you cannot convict two people when you can only prove that there was one culpable.
Yeah, and but you don't know which one it was.
Don't know which one it was. That's so they got away with it. The brothers were released, and the €5 million worth of jewellery and watches has never to this day been recovered. Another kind of whimsical crime that I support.
Yeah. So if you are an identical twin, you know, and you're stuck for a career path, that's something to consider. Cassie, thanks a million.
Thank you.
As ever, Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.